Okay, so Dr. Pete, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Thanks for joining us. So, again, as always, perhaps for those people who might have just tuned in for the first time, or for people that may have only heard of you once or twice, as well as those who are regular listeners to your show, would you just discuss your professional and academic background and how it's brought you to where you're at now?
I don't really have a professional background, I guess, but academically, I studied various things for an MA in humanities, and then 1968 to 72, I got a PhD in biology, specializing in reproductive physiology and the biochemistry related to it. But I've been talking to lots of people about biological ideas for about 50 years, and so my education comes in a lot of non-academic ways.
Okay, so I know that you're constantly researching both old as well as novel breakthroughs in the interpretation of disease and the approach to disease, which is less than mainstream medical approaches, because the science very often has a different perspective to which I think most people are subject in medicine per se. That is to say, I think sometimes the truth of trials and research that's done isn't always brought out to the public, certainly not in a timely manner. Maybe 20 or 30 years later, we begin to see the revelations from that initial research, and it comes to the attention of people, a bit like the U-turn, if you like, on the polyunsaturated oils that now are recognized as being negative for a person's health, rather than the financially viable, positive health benefits. So I think for this month, we talked about it a little while ago, last month or in December's show, about the treatment of urea in cancer, specifically with reference to a Dr. Evangelos Danopoulos, a Greek medical doctor, who actually was, you know, I think he was conferred an honorary professorship. I think they know him now on the internet as Professor Danopoulos. But ultimately, he published quite a few peer-reviewed papers in respected medical journals, those being things like The Lancet, and in the journal Clinical Oncology. One particularly, I know we're probably going to quote from, or you're probably going to quote from too, that were published in 1983. And he did some research prior to that in the late 70s. So some of the questions on urea and how a simple compound like urea that's totally non-toxic, extremely inexpensive and very well tolerated by all the people that were using it and people that use it per se around the world for various things, from skin conditions to these cancers that we'll talk about. What are your interpretations of the mechanism by which urea is affecting this anti-cancer activity? And then we'll get into some of the outright experiments that were done.
I think one of the essential things is that it inhibits nitric oxide formation, and nitric oxide formation is probably the main means by which stress of any kind can turn off oxidative energy production. And so anything that will turn off nitric oxide excess will restore energy production, and restoring energy production has all kinds of structural ramifications. The constant consumption of oxygen is maintaining and renewing the microscopic structure of a cell. The membrane people about 50 years ago were arguing that the membrane is semi-permeable, and it has to have pumps, and cell energy has to run those pumps. But in fact, there are no demonstrated pumps, and the pumps that they postulated would take many times more energy than the cell could ever produce. So the cell is doing something with its energy very different from maintaining osmotic balance. It's maintaining the structure in an atomically fine sense, structure right down to the electronic relations of atoms to each other. And it's this kind of balance that urea participates in directly, as well as helping to prevent the loss of the oxidative production of energy. So the energy produces this structure which has all of the properties of life, and urea fits into that in a unique way, so that if the normal amount in the blood is just a few milligrams per 100 cc's of blood, but you can increase that to 1,000 milligrams to 100, almost 1% of the blood, without disturbing things physiologically. Danopoulos found that when he got the blood level up to at least 85 milligrams percent, more than 10 times the normal amount, the cancers would start disappearing. And so it's a matter of concentration. Even before that concentration, it will have shut down the production and action of nitric oxide. But then it has these structure stabilizing effects. It fits right into the way water is structured, and it increases the ability of the cell's natural hormones to structure the water and a protein system the way the cell wants to structure it. So it's like urea is supporting what the cell wants to do, even when it's at these extremely high concentrations.
Okay, so it's a little bit similar to the electronic state structuring water, when we talk about structured water, that do you think?
Yeah, it's exactly what the oxidative system is doing to the electrons. It's preventing an excess of electrons, and toxins and carcinogens and radiation are doing exactly the opposite. They're putting too many loose electrons into the wrong places.
Right. So, and this, by your description of too many loose electrons, we can imagine those as being the what they call the damaging free radicals, and things
more extensive than that. It's the chemical system of the proteins contains a lot of sulfhydryl compounds, glutathione, that a lot of doctors are using intravenously as an anti-stress thing. This is a sulfur compound maintained by energy-rich fuel molecules, but it maintains a certain degree of oxidation in balance with sulfhydryl groups attached to the proteins. And the proteins they're like a reservoir of electrons at the right energy level. And the oxygen metabolism, besides providing ATP and other forms of energy, is preventing an overflow of loose electrons getting into the structure of the proteins. And too many electrons will de-differentiate the cell, move it towards non-oxidative energy production and the formation of lactic acid, which can start vicious circles.
Right. Okay, because I know I read several abstracts, if you like, published pieces of work done with various groups of people with cancers. I know he worked on liver cancer, was something I believe we brought out 2 months ago. The treatment and approach to liver cancer with urea. I know he worked a lot with people that had liver primaries and or secondaries. But the ocular cancers, the cancers of the eye, the melanomas and the basal cell carcinomas, that was pretty interesting, the way urea, again, was used in the treatment of those ocular cancers. And
his articles on that have photographs that show very vividly the correction, the elimination of the cancer and restoration of normal tissue. And one of the interesting things about urea is that at these very high concentrations, it is so stabilizing to normal tissue that it prevents the formation of deforming scars. In a 1935 publication, someone was describing its use in treating wounds of all kinds, packing crystals right into the wound or the ulcer or whatever was an open damage to the organism.
Okay,
putting the solid urea into it and leaving it would clear up the infection and stimulate healing, but it would heal without visible scarring.
And I read that it promoted a fairly rapid granulation tissue in the wounds, and that was part of its mechanism by which it achieved such good wound healing.
I was seeing a story about an African spiny mouse that can regenerate its tissue very quickly. Like they mentioned that punching a hole in the skin, it could close the wound by almost two-thirds in the first day.
Wow.
And in 3 or 4 days, the wound would be healed without a scar.
Now this, I think, from an energy perspective, is quite interesting. It's a bit of a sidetrack from the subject, but young children and young adults, they heal rapidly compared to older people, and that's got to be down to an electronic energy state within the organism, correct?
The oxidative metabolism slows down from early in embryonic development down to old age. There's a steady decrease of oxidative metabolism.
It's the downfall of all of us who are gradually gradually aging. Okay, so in order to very quickly again, in order to stave off that kind of electronic degradation and the inability to oxidatively repair, what do you think are some of the best tactics that people can use to maintain the ability to stave off that damage?
In the uterus, the developing embryo also heals without scarring.
Right.
And I think two factors are involved in that: the high carbon dioxide level and the higher urea and related compounds in the amniotic fluid. These in the adult also just pure carbon dioxide gas can be blown into an ulcer and stimulate healing, control other symptoms, reduce pain, and so on.
Okay.
But I think as soon as an organism is born, it starts interacting with the outside environment, where in the uterus it was getting its energy filtered through the placenta and making its own fats out of the glucose and fructose that were provided to it. And the organism using carbohydrate for energy produces saturated fats or omega minus 9 unsaturated fats. And when we come into the world, we're exposed to the fats produced by organisms living at a lower temperature generally. And the colder a plant is exposed to, the more unsaturated its fats are, and they're of a different type than we would make ourselves. And those interrupt our oxidative metabolism to the extent that we become saturated with them. And that happens progressively from the time we're born in old age, generally.
Okay. Well, welcome to this month's Ask Your Herb Doctor. Again, we're very proud to have Dr. Pete sharing his expertise with us on the show. From 7:30 to 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject of urea and the treatment of cancers with urea. And then in a bit here, we're going to get into some of the mistaken lies, in fact, maybe even purposeful lies that are portrayed in the media from various supplement companies and big industry related to estrogen and bone health and cancers and phytoestrogen's role in that. So if you live in the area, the number is 923-3911, or there's a toll-free number if you live outside the area. That's 1-800-568-3723. So, Dr. Pete, just going back to Dr. Danopoulos' work with cancer, he had quite a few cases, actually, of cancers that were completely healed. And I just find it so shocking when here is scientific evidence peer-reviewed in scientific magazines that are portraying various other experiments from drug companies and or individual research from universities that showed what happened. And I just find it hard to believe that this kind of thing doesn't perpetuate itself and become common knowledge to a point where it's actually taken up by academic institutes and made more viable.
The medical journals depend on the pharmaceutical industry largely. And urea that sells for a couple dollars a pound or something isn't a very good drug, especially a drug that cures.
Right.
Isn't a good drug, even if it's expensive.
Yeah.
A cheap drug that cures, it just won't work in medical system.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to bring these out just for those people that are listening. You know, I think we all have free choice, and to find information out for ourselves is always a good idea, rather than just listening to whatever it is that we're being told by whoever it is that's telling us. It's always very good, I think, especially in the age of the internet, where I know there's lots of bad information on the internet. It's not to say it's all good, but there's lots of places where you can go and you can read scientific medical information that you know is been researched, and you know it's been pretty well scrutinized. And when it's telling you that this kind of thing is being used to treat a cancer, it's very hard to ignore it. So I think just for those people that are listening, perhaps they might want to look at Dr. Danopoulos's work in the late 70s and the early 80s, and his approach to the treatment of liver disease with urea, as well as cancers of the eye. And then I think the other thing wanted to get into was just some of the amounts of the product. And as you've already mentioned, urea is extremely non-toxic. It's kind of odorless and tasteless, and it doesn't really have anything negative going for it. It's very well tolerated. So I know some of the instances where he's quoting case histories here, we're using something like 15, I know one of the quotes was 15 grams of urea in a quart of water, and this was to be drunk daily. So this was just a total amount of urea to be consumed every hour or so, you know, in the waking hour from, I don't know, from 9 or 10 o'clock through till 6 or 7 in the afternoon. So 15 grams of urea, and then there were injections that were done with a 15, up to 50, between 15 and 50%, I think the average was kind of a 20-25% urea solution for skin tumors, and that was found to be highly effective. And then I know he mentions, and this is a little bit different, I think, here in the States, we use blood urea nitrogen, but he was quoting blood urea as a level and quoting 75 to 85 milligrams percent. Do you know roughly what that would equate to, 75 to 85 milligrams percent? That would be...
I think it requires taking more than, quite a bit more than 15 grams per day. Some of the studies were using up to 120 grams per day, okay. Divided up in doses of about 15 grams at a time.
Oh, interesting.
And in the 1950s, it was probably the main treatment used for brain swelling, reducing brain edema.
Okay.
Because it's a lot of people were thinking of it as an osmotic treatment, and it was displaced by various osmotic substances with the idea that you would make the blood hyperosmotic to draw the excess water right. out of the brain into the blood. But urea isn't osmotically active because it goes right into the cells. And to be osmotically active, it has to be like sodium that stays outside the cell,
right.
Or like sucrose or some of the sugars that can't be absorbed. But urea goes into the cell, soothes the cell's excitation, changes its electronic balance, and lets the cell excrete, give up the water that it doesn't need, very much the way progesterone and thyroid work, adjusting the electronic state so that ion exchange system and electronic affinity for water is downgraded so that it doesn't bind so much water.
Right. Okay.
That same anti-edema effect is still here and there used for treating congestive heart failure.
Okay.
I was looking up the Mexican Pharmacopoeia, and I see that they still list urea to treat the edema of heart failure because it's a diuretic. It makes the kidneys work better.
Interesting.
But it also causes the muscles and other organs to not retain water so greedily.
Yeah. Okay, so you said again, just to quote you again, that up to 120 grams a day, you're saying?
For getting rid of excess water. That was the amount they used.
Okay. And then he also mentioned, in conjunction with urea therapy, a compound called creatine hydrate, and saying that the two of these compounds together was even more effective at treating these cancers than the urea alone. Do you know much about creatine hydrate?
No, I think it's probably having some of the physical effects similar to urea, but it also enters into the energy storage and management system.
Right, okay. All right, so for those of you who are listening, like I said, you know, you can look on the internet, type in Dr. or Professor Evangelos Danopoulos, and you can read all about his work with liver cancer, eye cancers, and other skin cancers with the treatment of urea. So it might well be worth some people who have a compunction to do it to take a look. Okay, the other thing that caught my attention here, and I don't know, it sounds kind of incredible, and I don't mean to sound like I'm laughing, but it's just a bit like the cancer thing. It's just hard to imagine that these things can go by and not make a big dent or a big impact, because the next statement was the common white and brown mushrooms, and we're going to get into aromatase and breast cancer in a bit here with the discussion on isoflavones and soy and why what they tell you is not the truth, actually, and this is the fact. But the use of white and brown mushrooms to inhibit aromatase and prevent breast cell proliferation. They were talking about 10 grams of mushroom a day. Presumably this is cooked now, because I know you've mentioned that regular white mushrooms and brown mushrooms actually contain a fairly carcinogenic compound, but 10 grams of cooked mushrooms a day reduce breast cancer by 64%. And then with the addition of a daily gram of green tea leaves, which we probably, all those health-conscious people have probably heard about the antioxidant benefits of green tea. With the addition of a single gram of green tea leaves, they got up to 89% reduction in breast cancer. I find that incredible.
You would think there would be more news about that.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that's a couple of things that I wanted to bring out. We do have a couple of people, I think, have waiting to take questions. So with the engineer here, I think he's going to be passing those people on to us here any minute. Yeah, so I think we have a caller here. You're on the air, and where are you from?
This is David from Missouri.
Oh, hey, David. What's your question?
Well, you know, when you were talking about urea, it seems like through the years I've read about indigenous people around the world actually using urine products
right.
for medicinal purposes. Mm-hmm. Do you think why they intuitively knew that somehow that was the urea within the urine had healing properties?
Yeah,
you know, and because those people are probably in a much cleaner environment, it could be possibly safe.
Dr. Pete, do you think there's anything to be said for the supposed sterility here of urine, given that you don't have a urinary tract infection, but its sterility and the high concentration of urea in urine?
Yeah, I've known quite a few people who did it regularly.
Okay.
And seemed extremely healthy.
Yeah.
And it's been the Chinese used it, for example, and one of their interpretations was that it was the steroids. They concentrated things like the metabolites of progesterone and pregnenolone from the urine,
okay.
and used these to extend the lives of the kings and rich people.
Interesting.
Interesting, huh? Well, and Dr. Pete, the main things that you promote, you know, eating saturated fat, getting plenty of sunlight, and a certain level of CO2, I'm not sure exactly how to ask this, but if we were to work backwards on the physiology of the human body, it appears that evolution of humanity occurred in equatorial areas and possibly in more high altitude areas, and I guess the warm climate would also be that you would probably be eating more saturated fat in plants and maybe in animals. Take your philosophy seriously and start doing studies based on that idea, do you think they would find that is how man evolved, and that moving away from the equator is where a lot of the problems are occurring for the human organism?
That's my orientation on the issue of origins. High altitude, warm climate, lots of fruit, and all foods would be more saturated in a more equatorial environment.
Do you think in general that people that are studying science know that that is the case, or probably not, because they're not warning us about polyunsaturated fats, and they're not telling us we need more sunlight, and they must be oblivious to that, I guess.
Yeah, I ran across publications in some of the fairly well-known food journals 40, 50 years ago showing that the fats vary with the climate, and that the fats have a definite function. Some of them are functioning to protect the plants against animal predators by poisoning them. So they put lots of the unsaturated fats in their seeds. That was recognized 40 years ago, that the seed oils are biological defense.
It almost seems like if somebody kept in their mind that, you know, we did evolve from an equatorial area, and that we do need lots of sunlight and we do need certain types of food, that it could actually kind of guide you. It's like so many people just don't get it, that they're not getting enough sunlight when they're further north, and it's almost like if they were reminded that your organism actually is adapted to an equatorial situation, that they would think more about that, you know?
And previously, when it was summer in the high latitudes, people were outside farming, herding the sheep or whatever, getting lots of sunlight exposure. And in the last 100 years, people have sort of moved indoors and gotten sicker, I think largely from deficiency of sunlight.
I don't want to interrupt too much here, but we do have three other callers on the line, so I just want to be fair to make sure everyone gets a fair chance. So,
okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your question, and thank you, Dr. Pete. Well, let's move on to the next person so the other two get a chance. Okay. Next caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
From Arcata, California.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. What's your question?
You were going to talk about fish oil, and I've taken fish oil, and I'm hearing you were going to talk about the negative effect, mm-hmm. that it's not always cracked up to be. Yeah,
it's unfortunate for you that the research that's out there does not make it to the popular mainstream as quickly as it would be good if it did. It's certainly taking a U-turn now. And I know, Dr. Pete, you spent quite a lot of your life researching the polyunsaturates and how damaging they are. If you want to briefly give the gentleman caller a synopsis of the polyunsaturated, especially the fish oil, and how damaging it is for you, I think it would be good for him to hear that.
The majority of the oils that we store are unsaturated. Our cells prefer to oxidize saturated fats, and so even when we eat a mixed fat diet, our tissues with aging tend to load up on the unsaturated. And the N-3 fats, double bonds are farther from the acidic end, which is what is handled biologically, and the acid end protects against oxidation. So the N-3 fats are more unstable in the presence of oxygen, and so we don't store so much of those. So with aging, our bloodstream, every time we're slightly stressed, our bloodstream gets a fairly high concentration of N-6 fatty acids, which produce the toxic prostaglandins that produce brain cell damage and inflammation and so on. And so if you take a meal of fish or eat some fish oil, these oxidize very quickly and form compounds that will interfere with the formation of prostaglandins. But in doing that, they're also suppressing the immune system. But you get temporary relief to the extent that you're overloaded with the most toxic N-6 fatty acids. People experience some relief of inflammation when they take fish oil, but in the long run, that's doing its own damage because it's so highly oxidizable. In some experiments, N-3 fats increased the metastatic spread of cancer cells.
Okay. Did you get that, caller?
Yes, I did. What would you recommend for as something that would a substance that we take that would promote healthy brain function, or maybe even the regeneration of brain cells and that, instead of fish oil?
Well, I know that Dr. Pete definitely espouses the saturated fats as very protective, both stabilizing cell membranes and being cardiovascularly protective, which is not what you'll hear if you read the newspapers or magazine articles. But in terms of anti-inflammatory effects, the saturated fats are definitely better, and for brain function, for stabilizing the membranes in brains, that the saturated fats are certainly going to be the protective compounds. So coconut oil, palm oil, butter, animal fat, and I've got to say a caveat to add to the statement, animal fat. You need to make sure the animals are certified organic, otherwise most of all the residues of whatever pesticides or hormones or antibiotics they're treated with will wind up in their fat, so you don't want to eat the fat of a non-organic animal.
And it depends on what fat the animals were being fed.
Right.
Chickens are highly polyunsaturated. Pork, for the last 50 years, has been very full of polyunsaturated fats, even though lots of science papers are treating lard as a saturated fat with a 35% or so of PUFA in it. It's definitely a risky fat.
Okay. So we do have three more callers on the line, Dr. Pete. So thank you for your caller, and let's move on to the next callers. So next one, you're on the air. Where are you from? Hello?
Is it me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Where are you from?
All right. up on Bell Springs.
Okay. Fairly local. What's your question?
Okay. My question has to do with breast health, and I know you're going to address that in the future on the program. What I would like to ask is that you address urea in reference to breast health, and particularly fibroids.
Okay. Dr. Pete, did you hear that? The reference to breast health and fibroids and the benefits of urea?
I don't know of any particular treatments or programs for those with urea, but the diet that favors the formation of urea rather than its antithesis, nitric oxide. It happens that the amino acid arginine can either form nitric oxide or urea, and irritants, anything toxic, tends to shift it away from forming urea and going to nitric oxide. So avoiding the polyunsaturated fats helps you maintain the proper amount of urea formation.
Okay, because, caller, I don't know if you heard the earlier part of the show. I wasn't making a reference, or we weren't making references to urea specifically to breast health, but we were, if we have the time here, enough, otherwise we'll do it next month, we were going to get into the common lies and mistakes that people are told about polyunsaturated oils and estrogen and its supposed health benefits, because there's plenty of scientific evidence to show that estrogen is actually very damaging, and that in terms of breast health and fibroids. I know, Dr. Pete, you would agree that estrogen is probably one of the main contributory factors for fibroids.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Low thyroid
causes
the ratio of estrogen to progesterone and androgens to be very high. And both endometriosis, uterine fibroids, and also a breast fibrocystic disease, all of these go with high estrogen, low progesterone, and low thyroid function.
Yep. Okay, caller, does that help in any way?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much. I just was curious, because cancers were being talked about in relation to urea, if it also then translated to breast as well. So that did answer it. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. So like I said, if we get a chance here, we'll get into the estrogen, negative effects of estrogen, and talk about isoflavones. But we do have a couple more callers. So let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Hi, I'm over the hill by Alder Point.
Okay, and what's your question?
About insomnia. I take 3 blood pressure pills for high blood pressure, and I sleep maybe 1 to 2 hours, and it takes me 1 to 2 hours to go back to sleep, and I'm just exhausted. I can't nap. I get anxiety attacks. I have shingles.
What?
And I heard that tart cherry juice, 1 to 2 ounces, helps sleep.
What was that again? What was that product again?
Tart cherry juice.
Tart,
I heard that on
tart
Dr. Oz. I haven't tried that.
Okay.
But everything I've tried over the counter, medications, nothing helps.
No, I bet. Dr. Pete, you're going to say this
I'm
is
exhausted. I'll take my answer off the air. That way I could write.
Sure. Okay, Dr. Pete, it's probably an over-adrenaline situation, but how would you best describe to this lady what she could do to get some sleep?
Checking, having a test for thyroid function is important.
Oh, my sister has Graves' disease.
There you go. Go ahead, Dr. Pete.
Blood sugar is always a problem at night. Effect of daylight is to maintain efficient oxidative metabolism, and just 15 minutes of darkness is enough to lower the efficiency of mitochondrial respiration. And so keeping very bright lights right up until bedtime will minimize the fall of blood sugar, but having a carbohydrate meal late in the afternoon or before bed, a glass of orange juice or milk with honey. Sometimes the just the dose of sugar is enough to put you to sleep for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and it takes time for the liver to start storing glycogen, so it's good to have another glass ready for when you wake up, have another dose of orange juice or milk and sugar. And salty things, salty snacks at bedtime help to stabilize the blood sugar and energy production. So like milk and maybe salty tortilla chips or puffed pork rinds, something, a salty snack as well as...
Even with high blood pressure, think it's okay?
You have to take into account what drug you're taking, but vitamin K is a very important nutrient for regulating blood sugar, blood calcium, and blood pressure. I've known people who in a week or two lowered their points, their blood pressure by 100 points, 240 to 140 systolic pressure.
Really? From taking vitamin K?
Yeah. So you have to, if you're already at normal blood pressure, you have to be cautious and watch what's happening if you supplement large amounts of vitamin K.
How much would I take in milligrams? Not much.
5 or 10 milligrams is a pretty safe dose.
How about vitamin D?
That's essential. If you aren't getting regular sunlight or using a D supplement, you probably should have a blood test, because low blood vitamin D down around 20 on the scale should be around 50 points. Between 30 and 100 is the normal range. But
I'm sorry to interrupt. So just get a complete blood panel, like?
You have to ask for a specific vitamin D3 test.
Oh, vitamin D3 test. Okay.
And you don't want the activated vitamin D. It's the 25-hydroxycholecalciferol that you want to measure. And that's very important. Both vitamin K and vitamin D prevent the excitatory excess. It's essential to have your calcium regulated.
Could I ask you how I could speak to you? You have an office in Garberville?
Dr. Pete doesn't have an office in Garberville, but I do. If you wanted to, you could consult with me at any point in time. You can just contact me Monday through Friday. I'll give the number out at the end of the show.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Appreciate you're welcome.
Your time.
You're welcome.
A lot.
Yeah, you're
okay.
welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. We do have two more callers on the air, so let's take the next caller. Caller, you're on the air.
And
where are you from? Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions. One, I want to know about this urea, if it's so good for cancer, and you say even cancer of the liver. I know liver cancer is very difficult to treat. Why is this not a more popular treatment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. It's I don't want to say it's conspiracy, but I think sometimes simple things get buried, and I think the truth of that is that when things are so simple, they'll quickly get buried under a pile of papers that are supporting the latest and greatest treatments. And as we know, there is no real treatment for cancer. I think the cancer industry probably has one of the worst track records going for cures. So.
Well, it seems like, I have a friend that got over cancer with radiation and chemotherapy, and she beat it, and she had a couple of large tumors. So these things do work, maybe not always 100%, but more than they used to.
Yeah, I think there's lots of things to look out for, though, in terms of relapses with initial treatments. But that's not to say that everybody, it gets a relapse and ends up with cancer down the line. The 5-year mortality for cancers are post-operative are pretty poor in most cases. There are not many cancers that have that truly resolved.
Well, they get a little time anyway. If they don't do anything, they die.
Well, yeah.
Now, the other thing I wanted to know is I was taking something called glucosamine MSM for joint flexibility. What is this MSM? Do you know what that is? They said it was a sulfur that your cells needed or something. Is that important to take as a supplement?
It is a sulfur compound, but I don't know Dr. Pete. Dr. Pete, what do you have to say about MSM?
I think you should be very cautious and read some of the actual research articles on PubMed about it. Glucosamine, or which was the...
Glucosamine with MSM.
The glucosamine is... it's suspected of being a factor in creating diabetes if you take too much of it for too long.
But what about the MSM? What is the problem with that?
That it can be toxic in itself.
Toxic? How? I mean, and how much would that be? Because what they told me was that it was something that was that your cells needed to be healthy.
Cells definitely don't need it, but it's tolerated in fairly large amounts, but it can also be toxic in those amounts.
Okay, so what are the amounts that are safe? You don't know? Okay, the other one thing I want to ask you, you know, you were saying that fish oil is not so good, but what about, I heard that fish oil, like omega-3s, were really good for the heart. What do you think about that?
No, the studies have all ended up pretty negative.
What studies are negative?
When it's used for a short period, you can do things like lowering cholesterol and lowering blood pressure, but it ends up with the toxic immune suppressive effects.
And it also has thyroid suppressive effects, very negatively impacting the energy supply and the energy
production.
You're
saying that the omega-3 lowers the thyroid function?
Yeah, and they're specifically thyrotoxic. So
really?
Yeah.
I have to take thyroid.
Yeah. Okay, so they produce the byproducts of these polyunsaturated oils. The lipofuscin is one of the main thyroid suppressive compounds. And indeed, as Dr. Pete says, whilst in the short term, somebody who has plaque psoriasis may benefit from it, the actual reason for it is that the immune system itself is being impacted negatively and suppressed, and so therefore there's not such excitation going on with rapid cell turnover in the immune system.
Well, why is it so popular?
Popular because it's an extremely profitable product.
Margarine?
Sesame
tahini, that's made out of sesame seeds. Mm-hmm. Is that...
problem. It's a liquid oil. It's polyunsaturated. People don't get oil out of nuts and seeds. You know, it just doesn't happen. It's very small amounts. And so to consume either sesame or Brazil nut or peanut or whatever nut oil is consuming a lot of the product that you'd never normally get exposed to. And this is the whole rationale behind understanding the negative impacts of these oils. Is that...
So you don't think that sesame seeds have good stuff for you?
No, none of it. It's a very, very rancid, very easily rancified. They're extremely quickly oxidized and turn into a sticky goo on the top of the jar. Anybody can take the top of a canola jar or a fish oil bottle and you'll see how sticky it is, and that's because your oil's been so quickly oxidized. In your body, that same thing happens, and that oxidative damage is extremely damaging.
Well, you can tell if it's rancid by the smell and the taste. It's very obvious.
Coconut oil does not go rancid. You could keep coconut oil for years, and it will not go rancid because it's so stable.
Are any nuts good for you?
Not really. Well, I think one of the only nuts maybe that might be worth a mention perhaps is the Mauna Loa produced macadamia nuts.
Well, I was seeing on Dr. Oz that he said the cashew nuts were very healthy.
Yeah, no, unfortunately not.
Okay. And what about CoQ10? Is that a good thing to take?
Dr. Pete, what do you have to say about CoQ10? I think
it is good.
Yeah.
It's good.
It works with vitamin K to stabilize energy production.
Okay. Does vitamin K help vitamin D work better?
Yeah, they both do different things, but they regulate calcium, and vitamin K has that extra function of stabilizing energy and brain chemistry.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. We do have another caller, but if we can get this next caller, next question asked and answered in a couple of minutes, Dr. Pete, that would be great. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air. Where are you from?
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Bellevue, Idaho, and I'd like to know... you've discussed how it takes 4 years to change the saturated fat mm-hmm. ratio of your cells to a healthy range. Mm-hmm. What if you're overweight? Then does it take longer to achieve this healthy ratio?
Yeah.
So, okay, Dr. Pete, how would you suggest that somebody who was, I don't know that this person is, but if somebody was obese, for example, and they had all this excess body fat, which naturally would be pretty highly unsaturated, how would they go about changing the composition of their fat, not only by changing their diet to only include saturated fats, but how would they gently exercise and lose weight to do that safely?
Having your thyroid at the right level is one thing, and supplementing vitamin E, because when you're losing stored fat, it's going to travel through your bloodstream, and so you want to have a steady supply of vitamin E coming in. Maybe 50 milligrams a day would help. A lot of fruit, orange juice, for example, has safe antioxidants besides vitamin C that protect your blood vessels as the fat is being removed. Keeping your temperature steady at 98.6 or close to it during the daytime keeps you... burning your energy productively rather than destructively.
Okay. So, caller, there you go.
As long as you retain the weight, then you still have an issue then with unsaturated fat cells. Is that correct?
When you lose the fat, you're going to expose your tissues to that polyunsaturated fat that is in storage. And if you keep your liver energetic with a good diet, enough protein, 80 to 100 grams a day of good protein, and keep your thyroid function up, your liver will be able to dispose of some of that unsaturated fat as a toxin without having to oxidize it.
So gentle exercise, keep yourself warm, make sure your thyroid function is working well, consume saturated fats, lots of OJ and other fructose-containing fruits and or fruit juices to speed up your metabolism, and then coconut oil, obviously, as a thermogenic alternative to polyunsaturates as a saturated fat. Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for, so thanks for those people that have called in. Just want to give people a reminder of how they can find more of Dr. Pete's reference material on site. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Pete.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so on the internet, www.raypeat.com, raypeat.com. Lots of scholarly articles, fully referenced, research material. It's not hocus pocus, it's all research material. So just like Dr. Danopoulos with the stunning results with liver cancer as well as skin cancers and ocular cancers, there's lots of alternatives out there, and it's not wacko. It's just unfortunate it's not mainstream, but that's because it doesn't make too much money, I suspect. Anyway, for those of you who've joined us, thanks so much for tuning in.